Hey everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I appreciate you being here. I just wrapped up an excellent conversation with Kevin Stock, who is a dentist, an entrepreneur, a carnivore, and a fellow Bitcoiner. We had a wonderful discussion about health and fitness, probably centered most of our time on health and fitness, the carnivore diet specifically, but then talked a bit about how broken money incentivizes some of the shoddy research that we've seen coming out of the government and certain institutions over the years. And I think we did an okay job of tying it all together. Either way, I think it was just a very fun and interesting conversation, and I hope you enjoy it too. Alrighty, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Kevin here. Kevin, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. How you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on, Mike. How you doing?
Of course. Looking forward to this conversation. I think you and I have a lot of common interests, and so I'm going to use some of this time to just answer all the questions I've always wanted to ask you. But I think you're going to be a very interesting guest for many people. You certainly hit a lot of areas of interest for the Bitcoin space. Let's just start with, tell me a bit about you, your background, where your interest in nutrition came from, because I know you speak from obviously a dental perspective with much of the sort of content that you share and produce. But where did all this start, and tell us a little bit about what you do today?
It could be a long answer, but to keep it kind of short and sweet, the health and fitness journey, I would say it had two kind of halves to it. And the first half was the fitness journey of the health and fitness. So I was an overweight kid, and I was hellbent on figuring out how to not be an overweight kid. And so I was doing weird diets from the time, I'm talking like junior high. And I just posted recently on like social media, like I wrote a 50-page senior thesis on the obesity remedy. So I've been like thinking about fitness and fat loss and muscle building for a long time. And that led me to, in college, I got my degree in chemistry, did a minor in biology. I also got a minor in business, which we could maybe bridge later back to that, because that kind of brings me a little bit to Bitcoin. But all of this was, I was studying the sciences because I was kind of really just interested in applying it to health and fitness, and really at fitness at that time. How do I build muscle and how do I lose fat? I ended up going to dental school. Long story there, like why I chose dental school, not medical school or some other route. But went to dental school, and I was doing physique competition. I was doing some online coaching then, because really that was where my interest lied. So that was kind of the first half of the health and fitness journey. It was all really fitness focused, and I've always kind of been more like science leaning, fitness focused early on. And then it kind of turned into the health focus. You know, I graduated dental school. I started a private practice exclusively dedicated to treating sleep disordered breathing. We could talk about that, but that's snoring, like called upper airway resistance syndrome, all the way through obstructive sleep apnea. So I started practice doing that. And I really personally also got more interested in the health space because I was running a couple different businesses. I was getting worn down, tired. And I was like, all right, I've been into nutrition for so long. How do I use nutrition really to kind of up my energy and I'll say mental performance? So I can just go all day long. You know, I got so much stuff going on. How do I maximize my energy? So that's when the term really turned towards, I will say health and fitness. Like, how do I get health in the equation? And that took me to keto, which didn't get me exactly where I wanted. And through a long string of research and such, I really just started eliminating various kinds of plant foods, oxalates, various kinds of phytotoxins, which led me to just eating meat in 2017. And, you know, that's got me on kind of like the carnivore train. Like, the train hadn't really left the station then yet, but that's really about the time, you know, Sean Baker was on Rogan, I think at the end of that year, and everything kind of just took off. So I've been eating a very heavy meat-based, mostly carnivore diet for, I don't know, last 7 years or so. So I think that's a highlight of the journey, and there's a lot of different stops we could take on that path.
For sure. So I guess a couple of things. So first of all, do your friends and family think you're crazy? Do many people in your life think you're crazy?
I think so, but I think I've been so odd for so long that it's now normally odd, which is easier than making like a transition. Like, if I'm like a normal person, then you just go carnivore. All the people in your life are like, whoa, this, you're only eating meat. But, you know, I've been doing so much weird stuff for so long. It's just, I think it was came to be expected.
I think that's about how my family feels about me. So I did carnivore, like a very strict carnivore for 18 months and loved it. I started to get, and this is something Paul Saladino, I think, talks about. He started experiencing some issues. I don't know if I was experiencing the same issues, but I ended up sort of lethargic. And I don't know if it was a problem with fat content or electrolytes or something else, but I've reincorporated fruit. I'm still staying away from and raw milk. I'm staying away from anything else, any of the vegetables. I tell you what, it's the best thing ever when you are free from the belief that you have to eat spinach or kale or something like that.
Yeah, I haven't had a vegetable in a long, long time.
It's not a bad life to live. So the common concerns about this way of eating are, you know, high cholesterol, LDL specifically. I mean, the list is long. How do you think about those things? And you've written about this extensively. Obviously, at the end of the show, I want to point everyone to some of your resources, which are very well thought out and plentiful. How do you think about LDL, cholesterol in general, some of these other conditions that people are worried that you would get from eating lots of meat, lots of protein?
I'll say first, to caveat it all, is like what you're doing is, it sounds like you're eating the kind of the word I like is like a hypercarnivorous diet, which is defined by hypercarnivore animals, which are omnivores, meaning they can eat plants and meat, but they specialize in eating meat, which, and generally animal foods make up 70%+ of a hypercarnivore's diet. So I would classify humans as like a hypercarnivore species. And so if you're eating mostly meat and, you know, 30% of your food is from, you know, some fruits and roots and other, I would say, more appropriate plant-based foods that we're kind of designed to eat, that's a fantastic place for most people to be. So, you know, you're eating mostly meat, you're getting all your bioavailable nutrition, your healthy fat, all your protein on that side. And, you know, maybe you have, maybe you perform better, like have certain performance goals and you perform better, feel better with some fruits and some roots or whatever it might be. I think a lot of people will thrive in that area. So that's the first caveat. The second caveat regarding all like, can you do carnivore? For sure you can do carnivore. You know, I've done it for a long time. People have done it for much longer than I have and, you know, and are thriving. But there are a lot of concerns. And like you said, the concerns are wide ranging, from no fiber, no low vitamin C, cholesterol. I mean, the list goes on and on. What about this micronutrient? What about, you know, a thousand things? And I've spent many years kind of exploring those concerns. And, you know, I had those kind of same concerns over the years, which, you know, through researching those and personally experimenting and then working with lots of people over the last, you know, 7 years, have found, I would say, some answers. And when I say answers, not like proof, but more like evidence, right? So like supporting evidence of like, hey, this person has done carnivore diet for 20 years and they've eaten low vitamin C and they don't have scurvy and they're doing great. So how can you say like you need certain, you know, plant foods? Like there's no essential phytonutrient like only found in plants that we need.
So do you think some of it's like those potential needs are context based, right? So like if you're living an unhealthy lifestyle in other ways, maybe you do need a lot of vitamin C, for example. I don't know if that you believe that or not, but like, for example, some of your needs might vary. If you're compromising, you're not exercising, you're not exposing yourself to sunlight, you're not doing a lot of these other basic things. Is that kind of how you think about it?
Yes, but almost in reverse, meaning I say a lot of people, like the human species, a hypercarnivorous species, but if someone is extremely insulin resistant, diabetic and obese, there's a strong case that they should not be eating a lot of fruit. Like, so I would say, you know, let's really limit the fruit. Maybe you have like a piece or two a day, but really limiting carbohydrates, I think in that context, it makes a lot of sense. Whereas someone who's metabolically healthy, working out, like you mentioned, Paul Saladino, he's surfing 2 hours every morning and he's naturally, I mean, I talk to him, he's never been overweight. So he's never had that issue, which plagues 3/4 of the adult population. So if you're super metabolically healthy, you can have a higher carbohydrate tolerance versus someone who is diabetic, who's quite carbohydrate intolerant as kind of defined by their blood sugar and insulin levels.
Got it. So I interrupted to ask that. So cholesterol, some of these other things, maybe focus on cholesterol specifically, because it's one that is probably the biggest question mark.
For sure. And it's a super complex topic. And cholesterol can be, let's say, high for potentially okay reasons and potentially bad reasons. And so when it comes to carnivore diet, I'm trying to think how much detail we want to go into here, because there's a lot of interesting work being done by the likes of Dave Feldman and Nick Norwitz about lean mass hyperresponders. And I guess for some context, in, well, I think it was the end of 2018, so maybe I was like 2 years carnivore or so like that, I got my blood work done and my LDL cholesterol was high. It was over 200. My HDL cholesterol, the quote unquote good cholesterol, was also high. It was like 111. So my total cholesterol was over 300. But my triglycerides were normal to low, and like the HDL cholesterol was good. So it's kind of like a weird triad. You're like, what? Well, he's got really bad, high, bad cholesterol, but high, good cholesterol, and the triglycerides are low. So is that a problem? And this is like a triad we see in many people that go no or low carb, like keto, and are lean. And it could very well be a natural kind of phenotype. And the question then is like, so this naturally is happening. Is it a bad thing? And so, I mean, that's the next question. Like, is this going to increase your risk for cardiovascular disease? And your cholesterol, your serum cholesterol, like that's measured in your blood, is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. But there's a lot of other risk factors, like do you have diabetes? So if this diet gets you not diabetic, but your cholesterol rises, is your overall risk enhanced or not? So there's a lot of questions we don't know. My intuition is that no, it's probably not. But speaking to the lean mass hyperresponders like myself and many other people, if cholesterol does go up a little bit, all you have to do is add in 50 grams of carbohydrates, 100 grams maybe, so stay low carb, and that drastically reduces your cholesterol. And kind of maybe to round out this cholesterol discussion is, this year I just had my blood work redone, and it was different context than the previous time. So this time I was doing an 18-month bulk where I was eating beef, eggs, and raw milk. And the new thing in the diet was the raw milk. So raw milk has carbohydrates. It has lactose in it. And so lean mass hyperresponders, the ones with high cholesterol when they go carnivore, they're lean and they don't really have any carbohydrates. Well, at the end of my bulk, I wasn't lean anymore. My body fat was like 19%, which is not like super overweight, but it's definitely not lean. And I had carbohydrate in the diet. And guess what? My cholesterol just dropped basically into the normal range. It was still slightly high, but like I was no longer a lean mass hyperresponder. And so this is just to kind of talk that cholesterol is a dynamic thing that has a lot of variables to it.
Yeah.
And the HDL to triglyceride ratio is a good overall measure of metabolic health. And so it's not to say we should ignore LDL and, you know, ApoB and ApoA. Like there's important risk factors, but the common understanding is like cholesterol is bad, especially LDL. If that's high, bad no matter what. I think there's some strong arguments against that.
Got it. Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think listening to you and guys like Sean Baker, as I've gotten my blood work back in, especially when I was doing, I haven't done it post reintroduction of carbs, but when I was doing that, it gave me a lot of confidence that I really wasn't very concerned about the high LDL. I think I was a lean mass hyperresponder. I know my LDL was over 200. Yeah, I think it's like 212 or something like that.
It's like same as mine.
So this is a personal question now. The only thing that did concern me a little bit, just because I don't know enough about it, is that my cholesterol, the last couple of times I've done it, all on a pretty strict carnivore diet, has been pattern B. What does that mean exactly? And what would you say? I mean, should that be concerning, or is that, you know?
I think you have to look at everything in just the overall context. So you have pattern A, yeah. Pattern B, the particle number, so LDLP, which is strongly correlated with what we were just talking about. LDL, excuse me, I'm getting ApoB, sorry. So LDLP, the total particles, strong correlated with ApoB. So those are more or less interchangeable. And I will say traditional thinking is the higher ApoB is the higher cardiovascular risk. And then the pattern is the size of the particles also influences risk. And I think if we peel back the onion a lot, it's all the other risk factors that come into play. Like if you have bad numbers, but you're also metabolically unhealthy, those bad numbers are probably very significant. Like you need to heed warning. If you're like yourself and you're lean and you're fit and you're working out and you're young and you're eating well and you have some quote unquote bad numbers, I think the risk that they add towards cardiovascular disease is much less. I don't want to say negligible, not like you shouldn't be just, you know, be aware of it. But like you said, I also had high cholesterol and was not in the least bit worried. And if you start digging into some of the research, because like I was like you, a little bit concerned. My cholesterol was super high, which is the only reason why I know a little bit about cholesterol at all right now. It's because I had the high cholesterol and I did the research. You start looking into it, like there's concern for low cholesterol. Like to me, especially when I look at family history of having grandparents that had dementia, it's like, whoa, you don't want low cholesterol. And cholesterol plays a very important role in the immune system and longevity and brain health. So I think there's two sides of the coin that we got to evaluate there.
Right. Yeah, and so many confounding variables and a very unhealthy population upon which to run these tests. Exactly. And numbers and experience. Like it's so hard. Like we just don't even have, it feels like this esoteric health movement, sort of like lots of sun exposure, lots of meat, like all the things that you talk about and that I've gotten more. I mean, my poor kids, I stuff bacon down their throats in the morning and they get out in the sunshine with as little clothing as I can, allow. Like that's sort of the way we go, but it's hard. It's hard because you have so many people from so many different backgrounds who come into these studies, and it's just, I don't even know how you begin to piece through that. I'm just glad I'm not like the statistician or the person on the back end trying to pull anything useful together.
For sure. It's like my mom was a cardiac rehab nurse for over 40 years. My brother is a classically trained medical doctor. He's an ophthalmologist, but it's like, so I mean, I've seen like a lot of the traditional medicine. And what's an interesting anecdote is, so my mom was a cardiac rehab nurse for a long time. And I just remember being a kid and, my dad had high cholesterol and she's force feeding him fake cheese and he hates the fake cheese. He just wants the real stuff. And then we find out 10, 20, however many years later, it was like, oh, that fake cheese was trans fat and that's actually clogging your arteries. And there's stories like this that just repeat through history of like things that we think, oh, we're going to do this because it's good for you. And it's like not. So the science isn't settled. And I think this cholesterol debate like that we're talking about right now and the work that's being done in that area is super important.
Yeah. And that's something else you've talked about before is that, the people who quote unquote trust the science, it's like this is a never ending exploratory mission that a lot of different people are on from different backgrounds. So what is it that you think, like what's led us here today? Like why is your opinion of health and what makes for an optimal, healthy human being so divergent from the mainstream?
Well, I think if you just look around at the mainstream, like if people are following the guidelines, it's obviously not working, right? Because like we're ever breaking records of chronic disease. Like, so if you just look at the percentage of people that are overweight, obese, diabetic, cancers, you name it, like everything. And even like life expectancy, like it has obviously risen and not a small part due to, advances in medical technology, as well as like prevention of like childhood mortality, things like that. But even life expectancy is starting to like curve over. So like a lot of things are going in the wrong direction. And so just to blindly say, hey, mainstream advice is correct, I think to me, that doesn't make any sense at all. So yeah. I actually do like to take kind of a, I like to take like zoom out evolutionary biology, ancestral perspective on things. And it's like all other animals in the wild, they know what to eat instinctively. You don't got to tell them like, hey, you need exactly what to do. Right. Yeah. So I like to think of, if we were to talk about like human evolution timescales, like the human genus goes back 3 million years to Homo habilis and Homo sapien 300,000 years. And the agricultural revolution, which was where we started cultivating crops just in the last 10,000 years. And so in the scope of like, which by the way, these crops now make up over 70% of the world's diet, corn, wheat, rice, soy, sugar, like that's over 70% of our diet. We as a species, we're not eating that prior to the agricultural revolution, which now makes up the vast majority of our calories. So I think it makes sense to be like, hey, this species of ours evolved over a very long time eating a certain diet. And there's strong arguments that can be made. Like literally we evolved because we started with the fork. We diverged was because of meat and was very much allowed us to grow these massive brains compared to our body size. Like if you look at humans, like what's the most distinguishing feature between humans and other animals? It's like our brain to body size ratio. And So long story short is this ancestral perspective, you start asking the questions, well, what do they eat? What do they have access to? And what would be like a natural, it's like basically starting from first principles. And you'd be like, well, what would we have access to back then? If I dropped you in an African safari right now, like what would you be eating? I'm telling you, you're not going to be eating grass and like leaves off trees. Like you're going to be hunting animals. And so with that perspective and my journey through being a fat kid and learning how to not be fat and what the mouth tells us we should eat, because there's certain foods that are just going to wreck your mouth. Like putting these puzzle pieces together has kind of led me to a strong conviction that we are a meat eating species, and like the mainstream advice is pretty much backwards.
So I have a mainstream doctor that I go to because he's close by. And if I occasionally need a steroid shot or something for an injury or something, I like to have someone I can call. But he's very worried about my LDL or my cholesterol in general, certainly my LDL. Can't explain why my resting heart rate is, you know, in the low 50s, or like everything else is healthy. My HDL mm-hmm. and triglycerides are good. But we kind of got into an argument the last time I was there about exactly what you're talking about here. You know, humans have been eating meat since the beginning. And presumably in my mind, fruit as it's available. It's a very seasonal thing. If you're, you know, migrating from place to place, you're going to find it sometimes and you're not other times, and you're going to have to rely on meat. And he told me that no humans have always eaten plants. And it's, to me, that's just, no one is picking up a raw anything off of the ground, any green thing, and eating that preferably over meat. And I think to your point is the science that we do know, what we do know doesn't indicate that anyway. But even just practically, if that were an up in the air question that you could really ask, would anyone preferentially choose grass to your meal as an example over meat? And it's like 0% of the time is anyone doing that. So it's such an interesting thing.
That's the basis of the expensive tissue hypothesis, which is basically if you were to try and eat like a raw plant-based diet out in the wild, right? So like throw you in that African safari and you're just trying to live off plants. You literally, like, our guts cannot, like, as we are, like, if you look at a grill, they got this big gut because they ferment fiber into short chain fatty acids. And so they're basically on a high fat diet. They're converting that fiber into fats. Our digestive system, like our anatomy, can only do that to like a small appreciable amount. So like you could not survive that way. And so the expensive tissue hypothesis was basically says in order to grow these big brains and fuel the energy while having, like, we had to shrink our guts and we had to move to an energy dense food source, which would be meat. And so, yeah, I mean, I would like to talk with your doctor, but you could always just say, hey, well, we just look and see if there's calcium, you know, in the arteries. We can do CAT scans every 20 years. And as they come back clean, maybe you'll turn them into a believer in 50 years.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Well, I told him, I actually, this is funny, you'll like this. When I first started the carnivore diet, my wife, like, she trusts me. She kind of plays along with all my shenanigans, but she was concerned, you know, about, hey, you know, too much protein, high cholesterol, what about all this stuff? And I think I literally showed her a picture of you and a picture of my doctor. And I was like, hey, this guy, Kevin, like, this guy's been doing this for 6 years. And then like my balding, you know, pale doctor who, you know, probably has a few pounds to lose. And she's like, oh, okay, I guess maybe there's something to it. Let's step back then. How did we get to the place where I have a doctor who he's a good guy. I think he believes in his heart of hearts that he should be concerned about me. What was it that led to an otherwise smart person like him recommending something that makes no sense on its face, has proven to not work for the general population for, you know, the last 40 or 50 years? Like what were the incentives that have sort of come down to lead us to that?
I think there's a lot of converging things that led to this, because I agree most, almost all medical professionals are like well-intentioned. And I could give like an example in dental school, like we're taught to use this amalgam, which is the silver fillings, which is half mercury. We're taught like this has been the standard of care. We've been using this stuff for over 100 years. You just put this, like that's how you fill cavities. And so we're taught that in dental school, right? And now, like, now that I've been out for a while, like people are, don't do that anymore. Cause we're like, you know what? That really actually, that mercury is not good to have in your teeth for the rest of your life. The vapors go off, you know, so it's but we've been doing it for a century, more than a century. So it's like, it's very gradual. And I talked about like the trans fats, like Crisco came out in 1911, right? Crisco, the saturated fat. And it took till, what year was it? It took over 100 years before they were like, okay, FDA is like, these trans fats are actually clogging your arteries and killing you. So it takes a long time. So how did we get there in the first place? I do think there's a lot of factors. Ansel Keys kind of study seems to be like one of the hallmark diverging points where he started pointing like at saturated fat as the culprit and it's raising cholesterol. It had to do with President Eisenhower's heart attack. And it kind of set off this whole train of things that started pointing at saturated fat, which then red meat became bad. And that kind of was the start of things. And then I think there's a lot of, I'll say like corporate incentive around various kind of guidelines. So if that's bad, well, these vegetable fats, like the alternative, these polyunsaturated, unsaturated fats, cheap to make, very profitable, long shelf life. It's just easier from like, so there's like corporate incentives. And then, so these big corporations, like they're going to make money off selling you this kind of food. And then they, like sugar industry, notably, there's like a very famous that came out where I, like how the sugar industry was paying off Harvard like researchers to say, oh, okay, let's blame it on saturated fat and not sugar. But then you get basically what I'm trying to say is these corporations paying researchers to do research to hopefully get the outcome that they want. And if they don't get it, you know, keep running 100 studies until one of them gives us something we can take off, you know? So then we start getting problems with all the kind of research, which becomes almost meaningless. And so, and then I would say the third thing, we've talked about a few things there, is that there's a lot of people in the world now. And how do we feed 8 billion people, right? And related, what happened in 1971, when you go off the gold standard, things that you can't make cheaply become much more expensive. So it's like we can't just print beef off, right? Like we can't other kind of food products, especially like grains, which are cheap and we could process them and get a cheap source of mass calories. And so there's a role in just like, hey, how do we feed all the mouths for what they can afford, so to speak? So I think there's a lot of different factors at play here, and definitely money is one of them.
Yeah. So I was real quick before we, well, actually, no, this is probably related to money. Before we go down like the Bitcoin rabbit hole here, could you maybe just talk a little bit about more specifically how is most research around diet, health done, conducted, funded in the United States today? Just so we have some context for how these studies are produced, because it seems to me there's a lot of conflict of interest, a lot of competing incentives.
Sure, and I mean there is a whole breadth of research, some that is, I'll say, pristine as far as like no conflict of interest or incentives, genuine curiosity and scientific rigor going into it. But research is expensive, and especially getting meaningful human randomized controlled trial type research, the kind that everyone wants, like, oh, it's not a randomized controlled trial. Like, the nature of a randomized controlled trial with humans is small sample size and short duration. So then what happens within 8 weeks is very different than what happens over 80 years, right? So all research, there's no such thing as like perfect research. So everything is going to give you a little piece of information here and there. And really it's, you have to take everything with a grain of salt, meaning like, okay, that told us a little bit of something. And this epidemiological study is very limited because it is using food frequency questionnaires, which are classically like people are not good at recalling what they ate, but it gives us a little bit of information here. And so the first issue is like, there's no perfect kind of research. And so that, and you combine that with incentives that, and research is expensive. And so who's going to pay for it? And these various companies are incentivized, farm companies, food companies, to get certain research that are going to help their bottom line. These two factors come together and you just get research. It's like, conflict of interest, or it's like, okay, maybe it was done well, but it's like just one small data point in a sea of potential data points. And you think of, like, I alluded to it earlier, like if a pharmaceutical company is paying funding research, how much, I'm just always curious, how much research doesn't get published? So if like they paid for who knows how much research, right? And they get one thing that says, that kind of supports their stance, like there could be a sea of like unpublished type research, right? That really, it's like one out of 100 like shows that your thing's beneficial, but 99 says it's not or it's harmful, but the 99 didn't get published. Like that's a massively skewed result. So I think research is important. I read a lot, probably more than vast majority of people, but it's important to understand kind of the nature of research and statistics and conflicts of interest to try and put it all together.
Yeah. Does the federal government, where does funding come from them? Is that a common piece of the puzzle, or is it predominantly corporate interests?
It's all kinds. So I actually did undergraduate research, graphite furnace atomic absorption spectroscopy, where we use this fancy equipment to determine the lead concentration in local fish where I went to school. And the grants that we got, I'm trying to think, school, this, what's the whole bureaucracy part to fund that? I'm not entirely sure if that was federal grants, but the school applies for grants for various things. And sometimes they're paid by government, sometimes by corporate. And I think there's a whole whole array of ways of things that that get studied and funded.
This episode of the Bitcoin Way podcast is sponsored by us, your friends at the Bitcoin Way. If you rely on a third-party or closed-source hardware wallet for your Bitcoin custody, you are compromising on how you store your wealth. The Bitcoin Way offers white-glove service to help you take full self-custody of your Bitcoin and sleep in peace knowing you've done it right. Like most Bitcoiners, we believe that your Bitcoin stack will one day be worth a lot more than it is today. Go to thebitcoinway.com to sign up for a free consultation with a member of our team. Don't delay on protecting your wealth and reach out today. So let's shift gears. Let's talk a little bit about the money. I mean, first, probably anyone who is newer to Bitcoin at this point probably has no idea why we're talking because it feels like we're just riffing on something we're interested in. But there's a huge overlap in the carnivore meat-based sort of community with Bitcoin. How did you learn about Bitcoin? When did you get into Bitcoin and why?
So I got into Bitcoin in 2013. And the reason is, I told you, I got a minor in business in college. And in 2013, I graduated from dental school. And I was always very interested in business, but specifically kind of like startup technology, innovation type stuff. And so I guess I just always was kind of just keeping a pulse on like what's new, like what's going on in Y Combinator. I was just very curious in like innovation type stuff. And so I think 2013 was kind of like the first bubble Bitcoin goes mainstream, like the early mainstream kind of news stuff. So I remember I am not super technologic enough to usually be dangerous, and that's about it. So anyways, I get my first Bitcoin wallet, and literally like the private keys are in a Word document and the public keys in a Word document. It's just like, I'm like, all right, what do I do with this? How do I make this happen? Like, what is this? So it was really just exploratory at that time. But over the subsequent years, kind of stayed kind of bare, like in touch with it. But in 2017, actually, I was working on a business project. I was spending time in San Francisco a lot in this startup incubator. And there is like kind of like a startup hub all about technology. Bitcoin halving at that time just happened. And so it was really on my radar. And that's when I really kind of fully dove in that 2016, 2017 time period. So that was the early beginnings of it. It had nothing to do with carnivore or anything like that.
Because okay. I found out about carnivore from Saifedean from his podcast. So and amazing. I think I'd heard Jordan Peterson talk about, or Michaela, someone like that. But it wasn't until a Bitcoiner, someone like Safe who doesn't pull punches, who explained how ridiculous it is that that red meat is vilified, that I thought, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And so I kind of went down that rabbit hole after my Bitcoin journey began. So why do you think that there is an overlap between the carnivore community and Bitcoin? And is there something about the type of people? Because my suspicion is that won't last forever, because the Bitcoin community is, it's not homogenous, but there is certainly sort of a stereotype about the tip, you know, a libertarian meat eater type of a personality oftentimes. Why do you think that is?
It's a good question. And first of all, like Seif, his latest book, The Fiat Standard, there's a chapter in it called, I can't remember what it is, Fiat Food. Fantastic explanation of what I butchered earlier in this conversation, trying to explain how fiat currency really promotes the consumption of ultra processed foods, because foods like beef that cannot be produced massively cheaply become unaffordable for people. So his chapter in that book does a fantastic job kind of explaining how moving off the gold standard moved us towards ultra processed food. And then, so back to the question, why the overlap? I think it's an interesting question. I've thought about it a little bit. I think it's people that have healthy skepticism with, I will say, government.
the status quo.
Yeah, the status quo of like what we should be eating, but we're getting unhealthy. How we should use our money, and why do I feel like I'm getting poorer and poorer? Things like that where you're just like, what is going on here? And I think when you start peeling back the onion of both those things, you're like, okay, well, Bitcoin makes a lot of sense. Meat eating makes a lot of sense. And so maybe it's the kind of person that does their own research, so to speak. And those people that do their own research kind of conclude, yeah, red meat is actually a superfood. And this Bitcoin technology is a life raft off of a melting ice cube of fiat currency. So I assume maybe the overlap has something to do with that.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting phenomenon, because the more you get into it, and another thing that I would add to that is, and I've mentioned sun exposure. We've got a lot of, I'm actually talking to another prominent Bitcoiner tomorrow who's really big into sun exposure. I've heard you talk about walks you used to take shirtless, getting as much sun as you can. Still do. I see. Yeah, you're probably enjoying this this nice unseasonably warm weather here in March. Well, yeah. Talk a little bit about, I know we're jumping onto a new topic here, but I'm just curious because it's getting me thinking. What is it about sun exposure that interests you? Why do you think it's so important? How much do you try getting?
Yeah, I think sun exposure, it's interesting to kind of think about. Like, when was the invention of sunscreen, and what did they do before that? Was everyone just dropping dead of skin cancer? And you quickly realize, like, no, they were spending way more time outdoors than we currently are. And, you know, there was no sunscreen. So like, things automatically start not adding up. And we can talk about some of the reasons why I think, like, if you're eating a standard American diet, the sun can be quite dangerous to you if you've got all unhealthy fat, you're full of seed oils, right? But the sun is super important for all kinds of things, producing vitamin D is the obvious one, but also things like nitric oxide and endorphins, and it plays a huge important role in just overall health. And you can't just replace the sun with a vitamin D pill. So it's one of those things where vitamin D, if you look at vitamin D markers, it's like classically a pretty good marker of overall health. I'm not saying it's like causal, but it's at least a proxy measure of health. And the main way we're getting vitamin D is through the sun, and most people are deficient. And I just think it's one of those things, everything from your circadian rhythms being set via sun exposure to vitamin D synthesis, like I said, nitric oxide production, all these things are just super important. And most people, and I'm guilty of it myself, like just spending all day indoors, it set climate when, you know, I think the sun is a vital part of health. And we see that like life expectancy increases around the equator where people get more sun. So all kinds of things are, I think sun is super important.
Yeah, I bought myself like an inexpensive standing desk to take outside on nice days. And usually, probably on a day like this, I'd usually be out there soaking in some sun. So let's jump back as we round this out. Let's talk a little bit more about Bitcoin. What what do you anticipate here in the near future? Whether that's price action, or we've got the halving coming up in about a month, yeah. You know, probably in a week or give or take a week or so. What are you looking at, or what's exciting you about Bitcoin here in 2024?
Oh man, I mean, just excited to be out of the bear market. This last one was seemed like long, and I don't know, was it worse than the last one? It just seemed, I think I was drawing this picture up here during it. I'm like, man, this is not a good time to be working on this. I'm excited. There's so many interesting things kind of converging at once. And I think that's what I'm probably most excited about, is just to see what happens. Because I do think kind of this last cycle, it was blunted because of the miner ban in China. And I think this kind of cycle, I think it might surprise people to the upside, meaning we got the halving coming up. We got ETFs for, you know, the on-ramps of traditional money to be able to pour in. We got a dovish Powell looking to cut rates this year. It just seems like it's almost a perfect storm for risk assets, but I think particularly Bitcoin, especially the interesting thing with rate cuts coming with inflation still not down to target. And so you ask yourself, what's going on here? We're going to cut rates and inflation's still not where they want it. It's almost like, I don't know, it's almost like waving the flag saying like surrender. And like,
yep.
There's no better case. Like that's the case really for Bitcoin to just take off.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the next 12 months plays out in terms of rate cuts. I think at some point, it seems to me at some point from a macro perspective, something breaks and that becomes an optional, and you need to let inflation run hot. Unfortunately, I think so many people aren't going to have onboarded to Bitcoin and are going to be stuck sort of holding the bag. I mean, especially people who don't own assets and don't, you know, have a means of matching inflation, which is sad. So you and I, again, this thing we have in common is that we both do things that other people don't understand. What have you had better luck converting or making disciples of, the carnivore diet or Bitcoin, or flossing their teeth?
Definitely, I would say the carnivore diet. Man, I was talking about, I think just because I've had such a long history of just a nutrition obsession, and I'm more of a hobbyist when it comes to finances. And so my brother is he's a financial advisor. He's got a firm, Lake Street in Chicago, super successful. He got over $1 billion in management. But I've been talking about Bitcoin. I mean, it's been a decade now. And so I've kind of been like, it's more like, hey, this is not your lane. This is ridiculous. But with the ETF, I'll tell you what, that was my most like kind of happy thing about the ETF approval, is like, it just finally legitimizes, like, man, it took me a long time to kind of like be talking about this. I've been talking to, literally, I write the a newsletter, like you said, and I got like screenshots of like, it's 2018, Bitcoin's at 3,000. I'm just writing, not financial advice. I think this is a pretty darn good entry point opportunity for Bitcoin. And I got people unsubscribing and saying, you know, I'm a CFA, this is a Ponzi scheme, it's going to zero, hopefully you get sued. I'm like, man, I mean, it looks good now in hindsight. So I'm excited for it. I'm curious what you think is going to happen in the next couple of years. Like, you think we're going to do normal cycles? Do you think it's going to just, this time things are different? It's just up and to the right, like gold ETF.
What I'm optimistic about, I think that the ETFs could bring some stability to price. Like, I think maybe the swings could be less so, especially to the downside, because I think there are more people who are going to allocate a bit to the ETF because they've seen the long-term upside of Bitcoin, and they're not going to think about it, and they're not looking to trade it, right? They're just, it's in an IRA or it's, you know, wherever. So I'm hopeful that maybe some of the drawbacks we have moving forward are less pronounced. I think that, I think the hurdle for me from being like bullish to the upside of like a million, you know, a coin this cycle or something like that, is just that of adoption. It still doesn't feel like, and like, you go into a random bar and just say, who's watched a Bitcoin podcast or read a book on Bitcoin? And it's like 1 in 100, maybe, you know? And so I feel like there's a long ways to go on adoption. And Oh yeah. Oh no,
if
no.
If 90 out of 100 had it, and we're sitting at 70,000, it's like, well, maybe we'll get to 100,000, but
for sure, I think over a 5 or 10 year stretch, yes, like that is 100% bullish, and that means we're going to
another 10 years,
and we're going to 1 million or 10 million or whatever. I completely believe that. My question is, like, in the next 2 years, like this cycle, is that likely? I think we need more people adopting Bitcoin and recognizing it as an asset that is untethered from the current financial system, and recognizing the importance of that. And to your point, you've got a brother who understands finances better than either of us. And it's been a decade of trying to explain why this matters. And he's like, yeah, I don't get it. And so if someone like that isn't recommending the ETFs or an allocation to Bitcoin, neither are millions of other financial advisors, you know? And so that's maybe the one delta I see in terms of, like, reaching a really high level. I think we're hitting the hundreds of thousands for sure this time around, but we'll see.
Yeah. So in regard to the financial advisors, like, he never allocated to Bitcoin because it was too difficult. And now that there's an ETF, he's got clients, and finally, like, I get my parents getting some exposure. And so, I'm just excited because I do think, yes, like your point, it has not been adopted because it takes a degree of work.
Curiosity.
Yeah. You got to put the work in to get it, like, to buy it, especially if you're trying to buy it and self-custody it. And I think, I just think it's going to surprise you to the upside, especially it's like, yeah, maybe it's not going to onboard 5 billion people in the next 2 years, but think when it started onboarding, like, some of the, you know, nations, states, like,
yeah,
like a nation state of like a few leaders makes enormous potential waves. So,
my whole thesis. My whole thesis would be completely disrupted of more modest highs this cycle. I'm just saying, I think it's going to be in the couple $100,000 range.
Which is like bullish,
but
it's bullish.
So. Which is bullish, but not uber bullish.
Right.
I think what disrupts that hypothesis is like, an oil producing nation, you know, UAE, someone like that coming public or being found out that they've been, you know, slowly accumulating. Mm-hmm. And because I think that's where, like, the world begins to move to a Bitcoin standard, you know, when you can start to denominate some of the most important commodities in Bitcoin, that's a pretty powerful catalyst for change. So,
for sure.
We'll see if something like that happens. It sounds like, if you know Samson Mao, Jan 3, he's a so he's predicting $1 million Bitcoin this year or next, and I think he's right if one of those sorts of things change, like, or even, you know, Apple begins adding some to their treasury, or, you know, and then Amazon and Microsoft say we need to be doing the same thing, like, that
the game theory of the big wallets, I think, like you're saying, is people are like, oh, they're doing it, we got to do it, so we don't
exactly. But what I do know is, for the next year and a half or so, I can smugly, you know, greet my friends and family who have doubted, and then it'll probably crash to some degree, and they'll be making fun of me at 150,000, and I'll be laughing that they don't realize that it's still doubled since today. You know.
So do I was just gonna say, you have a macro thesis contingency if there's a hard landing? No one's even there was all the talks about, like, a soft landing, and now there's no landing. And some people were that I follow, like, that I think are smart people, Preston Pish, are like, hey, this is going to be a hard landing. So do you think that's even possible? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be interviewing you at all. I'm just curious.
No.
Like, it could,
like, what happens if there's a hard landing with Bitcoin?
That's one thing I think that derails this current bull market is if there's, like, an economic hard landing that we can't print our way out of. So, but maybe that's what we would do.
Well, so I think that temporarily, so I'm not a finance guy, so I'm making this up as I go. So I think that temporarily, yes, you'd see a major hit to the value of Bitcoin in a hard landing situation. But I think and this is something, like, James Lavish talks about, is like the just mind melting amount of print,
the COVID response,
monetary. Yeah. The COVID response times 10 or 50 or 100, you know? And that would do amazing things for Bitcoin, although the dollars that it's valued in would be $1 million Bitcoin means a lot less right. when you print another 20 trillion right. than it would, in today's dollars. So I don't know what that means. And that's why I think the adoption piece is so important. And to your point, I think institutional sovereign nation, I think those are the big players, but adoption in general is so important is because you need people who recognize it as better sound money and not as some speculative asset that might make their retirement portfolio, you know, notch up another 2% when they reach age 65, you know, and you need people with conviction. And I think we're a ways away from most people understanding that. But again, if there are certain countries in the Middle East, Russia, honestly, China, big producers, you know, net exporters, I think they could have a huge impact long term if it becomes public that they're on board.
Yep. I think you're right where it's like, if this sentiment changes from greed, like, hey, I want this because I want to get rich, to fear, like, I need this so I don't get plundered, that is when that's when the mass adoption occurs. People will act out of greed, sure, but out of fear, everyone's like, hey, everyone's acting out of fear. Like, fear is a stronger motivator than pleasure.
Yeah. So one of our partners at the Bitcoin Way was in Lebanon when their currency collapsed. And so he is just a fierce advocate of Bitcoin for obvious reasons. And, you know, just talks about like the hell that you see when that actually happens. I think in the West, we're so far removed from that. But we have to remember that there are, you know, 4 to 6 billion people around the world who are much closer to that than we are. And if they experience the pain or they anticipate the potential pain and begin to onboard, like, I think that the adoption is almost more important globally than it is in the West because we don't realize how fortunate we are to have the global reserve currency, to have relative price stability. I mean, 10% inflation is no big deal if you're comparing it to someone like Argentina or Lebanon, it's literally collapsing and what you had is worth nothing the next day. So, all righty, let's round this out here. So I'm going to just do real quick. I want you to give your best succinct advice for anyone who is looking to improve their dental health. And I'm going to do the same thing with carnivore and what you'd recommend there.
The biggest thing to improve your dental health is to improve your diet. And that means eating a lot of chewy meat, actually using your jaw muscles, chewing that meat. That's going to give you the nutrition, the vitamins, minerals, protein, and healthy fat, as well as the exercise that your mouth needs. And then limit the refined grains and the sugars. That's the biggest thing you can do for your oral health, bar none. Yeah. The second biggest thing is close your mouth and breathe through your nose all the time. Only when you're talking like this is the time when your mouth should be open. So right there, those are two biggest things to do for your oral health.
Perfect. You killed two birds with one stone. So give everyone a send off. Tell us a little bit about Meat Health. Before you talk about Meat Health, let me just share. I actually did a carnivore fat loss sprint through Meat Health with Kevin last year. I think it was last spring, and had an awesome experience. I'm actually April 1st going to be kicking off my own mini version of that. So highly recommend. I consider it a premium product, but it is well worth it to at least go through that exercise of learning how to do it. And I think for a lot of people, the accountability that you bring to the table is helpful. And then I know you've got sort of ongoing services for people who maybe need some more guidance around, their health and well-being moving forward, but maybe talk a little bit about that. And then the product you're working on, I'd love to hear.
Sure. So with Meat Health, we've really wrapped everything into, I'll just call it one program where you get like six programs. Because I'm working on so much stuff. I'm like, all right, Meat Health is, you enroll in one thing, you just get everything, which includes basically more information than anyone would ever want to know about, like how to not only do a carnivore diet, but also why, and also how to do it for fat loss, how to do it for muscle building. So it's basically a total nutrition course. And then there's also a workout program that goes with it. And so that's what Meat Health is now. It is just like one bundled package. So we've greatly simplified everything. So that's Meat Health. Really, I started Meat Health back in the very 2017. Like, it started, I was writing because I had been writing about nutrition for a while. And I was writing about like why I'm eating meat, just meat. And it evolved over the years. And after years of writing these articles and stuff like that, people were like, hey, I just want it all in one place. And so that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Like, you can find, I have so much information everywhere you can just find for free if someone's just curious about a specific thing. But if you just want everything in one bundled up package, that's what Meat Health, that's what, like, the Ultimate 90-Day Carnivore Challenge, that's what's all in there.
I think that's great. I think that's what a lot of people need, is just like, we're, it's kind of like Bitcoin, like the Bitcoin journey. It's like, I've heard about this thing. I have no idea really how to get started, you know? So that's a great resource. And then, yeah, continue.
Oh yeah. The product I'm working on, I've been working on for a very long time. Like, so I went to dental school. I graduated. I started practice just doing dental sleep medicine. It's treating snoring and sleep apnea. And as a dentist, we do it with these oral devices, and I'm not going to bore everyone, but there's good things about the oral devices, but there's serious limitations like cost and side effects, and they don't always work as well as you want them to. It took me on this long journey to starting to develop this thing, which is, it was originally called NED, which is a nasal EPAP dilator. And so basically it's this thing, it goes, we get two of them, you put them in your nose, and it stops snoring, and it uses EPAP technology, expiratory positive air pressure, to work. It has a dial on it where you can turn up and turn down the snoring depending on what snore strength you need. So I've been working on that for a long time. Actually, we are in the middle of rebranding it. It's got a whole new name coming, launching hopefully by, at the very latest, at the end of this year. I mean, I've just been working on this constantly. So that's a little bit about this. It's an anti-snore device. It's not going to be FDA cleared for sleep apnea because we're just going after the snore market.
Is there anything besides buying a device? Like, is it, like, if I'm a snorer, is there anything I can do besides intentionally breathe through my nose that would sort of help that? Is, I, like, what causes snoring? I'm going off on a tangent here again, sure. But like, what's the problem that you're fixing?
Long story short, is the turbulent airflow because of a collapsing airway. And so I would say the first thing is sleep apnea is probably the most undiagnosed serious medical condition in the United States. So many people have it. They have no idea. And even mild forms of that, like upper airway resistance syndrome, can really cripple your quality of life. You'll be fatigued. You won't feel rested, and really impair your health. So the first thing is, like, if you're having sleep problems, like, make it a priority. And so that's what causes snoring, and there's all kinds of snoring and sleep apnea. And there's various kinds of solutions. CPAP machines, there's kind of the classic way to treat sleep apnea. But as a dentist, we do oral devices, and now EPAP. This is more of, I'll call it, a newer technology. And so that's kind of the big picture of the snore sleep market.
What you're working on seems a lot more appetizing than like a CPAP or something like that. So,
The barrier to entry is like getting people, a lot of people know they have sleep issues, and it's like, okay, you got to go into your doctor. They got to write you a prescription for a sleep study. You got to go in, you got to go get a sleep study. You got to get that diagnosis. Then you got to pay for a CPAP. Over 50% of people that get a CPAP, even though it would save their life, they can't wear it. So then, like, what are the other options? You got these oral devices we already talked about. There's all these limitations. I was like, man, we need a simple, over-the-counter, low-cost, effective option that it should just be like the first-line treatment. No, like, no side effects. And so, you know, that's what I've been working on for almost a decade, believe it or not. Like, got the patent, and we're in the final stages of actually moving to mass manufacturing. We prototyped it for way too many years, lots of years of R&D. But now we're on the finish line, moving to mass manufacturing. So I'm really excited about it, finally launching.
Terrific. And new name for the product coming, so not Ned, but I assume they can probably find out about that at your website. So maybe
not. I haven't released it yet.
Not yet, but that's like the place maybe they should be checking.
No, yeah, the website will be updated. Yes, I actually haven't officially got the name yet. It's a long story of, like, I found the name I wanted. Someone owned it, but there was no active website. Doing the deepest search possible, I found who had it, contacting them, following up for weeks, and now he's an elderly gentleman and he can't figure out how to transfer it. And so I'm trying to walk him through, like, how to do a domain transfer. And so it's still in the works. I'm not saying it's across the final finish line until I get there, but it's, to me, it's a good lesson, like, for anyone that's doing entrepreneurial things, is like, you got to follow up and follow up and follow up and follow up 1,000 times. So, yeah, but the new name will be out. It's much better than Ned, even though Ned had grew on me because I've been using it for so many years, but this is much more self-explanatory.
Okay, good. And Where can people find you online? If they want to learn more about you, your research, all the things that you do and share.
Yeah, so I have a website at kevinstock.io, which has got links to every place, but also meet.health and ned.rest is the name of this guy currently, which hopefully we'll have a forwarder domain redirect set up soon to the new site. So coming soon.
Perfect. Hey, Kevin, I can't thank you enough for your time, man. This is a conversation I've been looking forward to for a while. Yeah, you bet. Everyone, check out Kevin. I've used a lot of your, you've got some great articles like on cholesterol, a lot of the questions people have. You do a deep dive on a lot of that stuff. Yeah. I think that's all at your website. Yep. Is that correct? Yeah. So check it out. Check out Meat Health. If you have some weight to lose and you want to get fit and stronger, this is your guy. So Kevin, thank you so much. You take care and hope we can talk. I owe you a steak now. We're in the same city, so I need to get you a steak.
We do need to get together.
Yeah, for sure. Well, good talking with you, Kevin. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
And that's a wrap. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kevin Stock. As I said, Kevin is an awesome guy, wealth of knowledge about so many topics, just interested in a lot of different things. I would definitely encourage you to check him out. Check out Meat Health at meat.health is the URL. I had a great experience. It sounds like he's sort of broadened what is included with his services. So I'd encourage you to take a look if you are someone trying to get started with carnivore, looking to lose weight. Again, not medical advice or, you know, this is just my experience. And would also encourage you to check out if you have a snoring problem, your significant other would love for you to check out and stay tuned for his upcoming product to help with that. But most of all, I'd encourage you to just look up Kevin on Twitter, X, whatever you know we call it these days. I think it's Kevin at KevinStock12. And he has a lot of just great content, very interesting and insightful things that he shares. And as far as I go, if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's the at the other M Jordan. And you can check out my newsletter at my Substack, blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. And of course, if you need help with self-custody of your Bitcoin, check out the Bitcoin Way. That's thebitcoinway.com or follow us on X. And that's at the Bitcoin Way_. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.